Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive functions. This show is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. These conversations will introduce mental tools that will empower you to shift your mindset for a successful life. And now, here's your host, Sucheta Kamath.
Okay, welcome back to Full Prefrontal, where we are exposing the mysteries of executive function. I am here again with our host, Sucheta Kamath. Good morning, Sucheta. Always good to be with you. Very much looking forward to your second conversation with Dr. Julie Washington. But before we go there, tell me this. What does Marva Collins, the great educator and champion for underprivileged children, what does she have to do with Chicago, Shakespeare, and inner city kids?
Well, good morning, Todd, and great to be with you as well. And you are from Chicago, so I know you have heard of Marva Collins. She was considered one of America's greatest educators ever. You know, people often marveled at her gift of unleashing human potential in kids, particularly those kids who were often considered unteachable. And she was able to turn them into highly engaged learners and highly accomplished students. So she demonstrated a method and commitment to make high academic results possible for society's most marginalized learners. You know, she was a teacher when she started, and she was completely dissatisfied with the way kids were being taught. And so she decided to start, you know, own school, and it was called the Westside Preparatory School in Chicago. She was once quoted that, "I work with disadvantaged children. I value their humanity and believe in their gifts and their strengths. And I'm committed to promoting their achievement at high level." You know, she's been covered in a movie, in 60 Minutes, or in a documentary. There are wonderful things that are said about her. Stanford professor Carol Dweck, in her book, Mindset, refers to Marva Collins and how she took inner city Chicago kids who had failed public schools and treated them as if they were brilliant and geniuses. And with that mindset, you know, she kind of helped develop and cultivate growth mindset in them. With that and tender, caring attention, they were able to read, study Aristotle, Aesop's fables, Tolstoy, Shakespeare, Frost, and I'm talking in fourth grade, you know. And so what's so beautiful about her story is that she often took the kids who were labeled as learning disabled, retarded, or even emotionally disturbed and give them wings to fly. You know, we are inspired by stories like that. Marva Collins is set to put in motion a creed that students were expected to memorize, 21 nuggets of golden principles, so to speak. Here are a few: that failure is just as easy to combat as success is to obtain. You know, another one is, "I will wave proudly my flag significantly that I am a failure by choice, but I will never envy those who have selected to wave their unfurled banners announcing their success." You know, things like that. Who would not feel inspired? You know, if you have a teacher like that, if you have a mentor like that, who have somebody who believes you and sees your potential and not your abilities as a final destination, it can really transform a child's life. So that's why we are going to talk to my dear, dear friend, Julie, again for the second time. Today, Julie is coming back to talk about educating the disenfranchised kids and helping such learners grow into their full potential, no matter what their social or economical background is. So here's a few details about Dr. Julie Washington. She's a professor in the Department of Educational Psychology and Special Education and Communication Disorders in the College of Education and Human Development at Georgia State University. She is also the Director of Communication Sciences and Disorders Program. She is affiliate faculty at Georgia State University's Center for Research on Challenges of Acquiring Language and Literacy. Her current research focuses on understanding the role of cultural dialect in the identification of learning disabilities in school-age African-American children and on disentangling the relationship between language production and comprehension on development of reading skills for children growing up in poverty. And you have heard her before, and she is a wealth of knowledge. She's funny, she's talented, and extremely compassionate. She is a fellow speech and language pathologist, and I'm so happy to know her as a friend. So here it is, Julie Washington. Todd. Yeah,
no, I'm looking forward to the conversation. And you're right, Marva Collins is an inspirational story. And boy, how powerful is that growth mindset when you can get someone into that. But I'll tell you, as you said, Julie's quite inspirational as well. So let's get to it. Here is Sujata's second conversation with Dr. Julie Washington.
Welcome to the show again. This is part two of our discussion, Julie. I'm so excited to talk to you about what is the solution to the issues of children who are being raised in poverty and folks who are trying to educate them. So I'll start with this research study that I read where the researcher said that for children to become more proficient readers, they need to learn 5 to 6 words per day, which comes to 38 words per week and, you know, totals to 2,000 words each year, which means by age 6, the child should be equipped with 10,000 words. So certainly there is a gap that's created between children who are growing up with great socioeconomic benefit versus those who are impoverished. Can you shed some light on that? What is the impact of this enriched language that the child brings to school?
Yeah, this is a real focus right now. In Georgia, I know, and across the country, not only in schools, but at the state level, people are really focused on this word gap and how much difference it makes in achievement. And so I do think that, you know, some of what we know about words is that, you know, you gave the statistics, kids need to learn 2,000 words a year. Well, how do you do that? I mean, do you sit down and which words do you learn? Do you just sit down and memorize them? And the reality is that some of the work that's been done in that area, particularly Hart and Risley from 1995, who sort of brought us to this idea of a 30 million word gap that exists by preschool between our poorest kids and the kids who are growing up in professional families. But one of the things that they really talked about was we're always focused on the quantity. Like if we teach you, you know, 2,000 words a year, then you will be a good reader. But what Hart and Risley talked about was the quality of the kind of talk that we are using with kids is what creates the quantity. You don't have to drill 2,000 words a year. What you have to do is use 2,000 words a year as the adult in the environment and use them enough and in a quality way so that kids are learning from it and generating new meanings and new words. And so when I talk about what language should look like in an environment for a child who's developing language and learning new words, it should be like color commentary in a football game where the adult in the environment is talking about the environment all the time and is talking about what's going on. It doesn't have to be sort of this question and answer kind of thing. There should be exchanges. The exchanges are very important. But the adult really should be narrating the environment. And that's not what we see in impoverished families. And research has shown that very clearly, actually. And it has great consequences.
Go ahead.
It has great consequences.
So is this now a factor of parents not utilizing effective language skills, or it's absentee parents, inconsistency, that all the toxic stress-related issues that you mentioned earlier? What constitutes this gap that it's not a matter of simple using or being exposed to? It has to be infused in their life, right?
Right.
And so what makes that gap? Like, why are they not living that life of enriched words?
Well, you know, some of the other things that we talked about, like parents dealing with their own stress, can influence the way people talk to kids. But one of the things that we saw with the Hart and Risley study was that some of they didn't interpret this way. It has since, you know, in retrospect, been talked about this way, that some of the ways that language is used are always influenced by cultural differences. And so people use language differently with children. And so, for example, in many cultures, kids don't talk to adults as much as, say, they do in some mainstream communities where you hear, you know, kids and parents going back and forth and having these exchanges. That's not always the case. And so what we found, what Hart and Risley found, was it was the way you use language that determines how much language kids develop. So, for example, in their low-income samples, they found that parents were really using language in sort of a utilitarian kind of way. You know, do this, don't do that. Where is this? What are you doing? I mean, things that were just about moving forward in your day instead of real exchanges where parents and children were learning things through their interactions. And that's a very different way of communicating. And what we find is that kids learn the most language when there is this like rich exchange between adults and children. And you know what? Not all cultures communicate that way. And do all of those cultures have difficulty with child language development? No. But in impoverished populations, we find that the communication style is different. And when Hart and Risley looked at parent language and child language, you can't teach what you don't know. And so the child who doesn't have a lot of words often has a parent who doesn't have a lot of words. That was the conclusion. Because the idea that this all starts with the child is a fallacy. Parents teach what they know and they impart what they have. And if you don't know a lot and you don't have a lot, then you're not imparting a lot. And we see that as detrimental to kids in classrooms.
Yeah, and this reminds me of Annette LaRue's work. You know, the longitudinal study of 12 families over 12 years. I hope I'm getting this right. But one of the things that what you mentioned about this, the utilitarian language, she was also talking about this language that was instructional or directive and don't, you know, full of negativity. So almost reprimand the entire interaction with the children, younger children, was to instructing them what not to do. And there was no language, enriched language experience. So that can have a very strong negative impact.
That's exactly what Hart and Risley described, actually.
Oh, gotcha. Maybe she's talking about that study.
So, not necessarily. I mean, there's been a lot of converging evidence to find that this is the kind of interaction that we're seeing in these families. And I think what people are starting to do is tie those interactions to the poor outcomes that we see when kids get to school.
So what is the first recommendation, or what is, in your experience, most effective way to convince, not convince is the wrong way, but like you mentioned, there are two problems I see. One is the very caregivers who are interacting with these children in poverty are not, themselves not experiencing enriched language. And second is there's a lot of chronic instability, which makes these interactions inconsistent. So what kind of impact seems to have, or what kind of therapeutic approach have most significant impact in helping promote these language skills?
You know, I'm not sure I can answer that question, which one matters the most, but I know that the strategy that people are using is to try to impact parents and impact their language and how they use language. And I do think that's part of the equation, that when you get to school, the school may use language very differently, but the place where you first learn to use language and develop your foundational language skills are at home. So like here in Georgia, they have an initiative at the state level, Talk With Me, Baby. And they are targeting hospitals and public health nurses and people who are encountering mothers during their pregnancies and teaching them before the baby's even born that you need to talk to your baby. And this is how you talk to the baby. You can have conversations. Because one of the things that we see, I think we see a lot, is that many parents, and they don't even have to be poor, but parents who believe, why would you talk to something that doesn't talk back? you know, so much of talking is about interaction. And so why am I talking to, you know, my stomach? Why am I talking to this, you know, little person who just cries all the time and really doesn't talk? And so sort of imparting in parents how from the minute that your child enters the world, that how much you talk to them and how you talk to them is really going to improve their outcomes. So there's that one side where we target the parents. Then when we get into schools, you see now in preschools and pre-Ks, there is a really, really intense focus on developing language and literacy skills, because we've all gotten the message that language is this foundational piece that's going to determine how well you succeed in other language-based skills like reading and writing.
Perfect. So can we talk about executive function then? How do we teach children, particularly in public schools, which accepts children from all social strata, and they're all grouped into one classroom. And as you mentioned earlier, those who have no parental modeling, or they have they're being raised in a very highly toxic stress conditions, they don't have the best impulse control skills, they don't have the best working memory, and they don't have the best mental flexibility to demonstrate adaptive skills. And those are the kids who are getting in trouble because they are not engaging in cooperative ways, they are not following instructions, or they are sometimes even defiant and difficult to deal with. So what seems to work with respect to that?
I'm not sure that there have been a lot of things that people have found that work really, really well across the board. But I know that there are curricula that are starting to be developed that specifically focus on executive function and are used with these poor kids. And so I think in classrooms, you know, when we talk about reading, we used to talk about reading and say, you know, we can do a better job teaching reading. Reading is not rocket science. Well, now we've come full circle and we are saying now, oh, yes. Teaching reading is rocket science. It's very, very hard. And Louisa Moats wrote a book about it that said teaching reading is rocket science. But when it comes to executive function, I don't know. I think sometimes I know it's not easy, but I know especially with little kids, it's really not rocket science. So some of it is, and this is my soapbox here, I believe that a lot of the executive function problems that we see now in schools, we created by thinking it wasn't a good idea, like it was a waste of time to go to recess, or it was a waste of time for kids to go out and burn energy on the one hand. But on the other hand, when you look at play, Maria Montessori said, play is the work of the child. And so that's where kids learn social skills, they learn problem solving skills, critical thinking skills, they learn conflict resolution skills by engaging with each other in play. And we have seen that just disappear in schools. And with it, we've seen a sort of parallel rise in what we consider behavior problems. And I think about when I was young and growing up, and I would be outside playing with my friends, and we'd be playing games in the neighborhood and then take them to school, like red light, green light, mother may I, games where you had to control yourself or you lose. And so you had to control your body. You had to be able to follow directions. And so I learned a lot in the classroom, but I also learned a lot by engaging with my peers in these sort of games that we created that really are executive function games. And so now what we're seeing in classrooms is teachers opting to take some of these old games like Simon Says, Mother May I, Red Light, Green Light, Karate, Yoga, and instituting them in classes and teaching kids how to listen, to follow directions. And when you look at the curricula that they're developing, they're doing the same thing. Like one of them has something called the freeze game. The freeze game is red light, green light, right? I say
yes,
right, and you get to move. And then when I say red light, you have to freeze and stop. And the last person to stop is out. And so you get this reward from following directions, controlling yourself, and the sort of taking sort of children's games away from children have removed that kind of teaching and learning without replacing it with something else.
Yeah, you make a very good point. And I think there are certain curriculums, particularly with very, very young children, such as Adele Diamond's, you know, Tools of the Mind curriculum.
Yep.
That's the one you're talking about. Yeah, that's proven to be very effective. The Chicago School Readiness Project, actually Clancy Blair's wife, I think, yep. Raver, they have done some longitudinal studies of efficacy of that. And then also the READI, R-E-D-I, that also seem to be, they're showing lots of effectiveness in school readiness skills through effective executive function training by teaching that, like you said, self-regulatory skills through play.
But now we're structuring something that we used to just do.
Exactly.
So we're structuring and selling something that kids used to do naturally until we took it away. And so
yeah.
If we have to take those things and commercialize them and put them into curricula, how about we just give recess back?
Oh my goodness. And then Carol Westby was talking about this particular thing that in New Mexico, one of those schools have reinstilled play, and the play has itself radically changed the behaviors of children. Their reading didn't improve, but their behaviors improved. So yeah, you're right. We are going lopsided ways to intervene something after noticing that it's absent. And particularly, as you know, with executive function, the dysfunction is much more apparent than executive function proficiency.
Yes. And so, you know, we are providing speech and language services in a homeless preschool. And we went in focused on early literacy skills like, you know, letter word identification, and had to step back and incorporate executive function into the curriculum so that kids would be able to learn. And I think that's the big problem, that if you are, I don't think you have to be sitting down to learn, but I do think that you have to be able to engage and give enough attention and be able to control your emotions enough that you can benefit from the teaching that you're getting. And we really had to take a step back with this population of students.
Well, as we come to the end, do you have any words of wisdom regarding this access issue? For example, you know, there in child that grows up in middle class has access to 13 books over his childhood, throughout his childhood, versus in poverty, you know, children growing up in poverty, there's one book per 300 children. And that really has such a, you know, learning language in a decontextualized way can have a tremendous impact in developing higher order thinking skills and extrapolation and inferential skills and all the skills that go into becoming college ready, so to speak. So any thoughts about what we can do? Because I feel there is the younger children, preschool and elementary, and then it's the middle school that things become even more complex when it comes to a relationship of poverty as well as executive function and all the literacy skills. All of them come together, and that can be a big problem if those who don't have access. So any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, the answer to access seems like obvious. Like, if the problem is lack of access to book, how about we make them more accessible? And not just, you know, things that you get because you can afford to do it. You know, we have our public libraries, which are an awesome service, but a lot of our low-income families aren't taking advantage of them. And I asked a group of parents once, why? You know, why don't you take your kids to the library? And it's because if something happens to the books, the parents have to pay for it. And so once again, even something that is designed to be free becomes an economic issue for these families. And it's not something that we really are in tune to. And I think if we were, we might structure things differently. I also think that when we're talking about schools and books, a lot of the schools in these poor communities do have a lot of books. They don't always use them in class in very effective ways. But it seems to me that some focus on sending books home with kids and not just hoarding them in the school would make a big difference. I had a grant a few years ago when I was in Michigan, and most of the budget was focused on building home libraries for students. And so every book that was introduced into the classroom, and we introduced a new one every 2 weeks, every kid who was involved got the same book to take home. And so by the end of the year, all these poor kids had a library of 25 to 30 books. And so it's like, if we know that the lack of access to literate material is the issue, then it seems like when we're thinking about the kinds of things that we are giving to kids, we would think about those things that are going to benefit them when they're in school, like books, and that the libraries would, you know, step back and think about the communities they serve and what is it that keeps people from coming into the into this structure without being so judgmental. They don't care about reading. Of course they do. They care about the success of their children, but where there's
absolutely
a child where who can't read, there's a parent who can't read. I think in many cases, more than half of the time. And I think that's something we need to think about, that where if kids are having difficulty with reading, often someone in the family is too, and it's often a parent. And so we have to think about how we approach the whole family, not just the child, because we're asking parents to do things they can't do.
Thank you so much for your time, Julie, and for your wonderful words of wisdom. And I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Right. So that was Dr. Julie Washington again. Wow. Another great conversation, Sucheda. Ah, gosh, any initial thoughts that you want to share with us?
Absolutely, Todd. Thank you for asking that. Let's start by rethinking bad behavior. You know, there's a natural process in development where skills emerge with maturity of neural networks, exposure to new learning and challenging experience and repeated practice. The result of standardized testing tells us that the formal learning, or what we say, the effect of education, can be measured. But the best judge of emergence of academic and non-academic skills is the behavior exhibited by the child. However, what often comes up in education is, why is it that for some kids, these academic and non-academic skills emerge in tandem, while for others, they appear to be problematic or create roadblock in learning? Teachers' comment about such child would be, he's quite smart and capable, but very immature. Or it takes a lot to teach him. So a behavior is much more visible and self-evident than the inability that causes that behavior. So it's fair to say that not all misbehavior is manifested by a learning disorder, but some of them can be, but quite often those who lack the ability or skill to control emotions or redirect behaviors can face a great scrutiny by those who are dealing with such children. And their disruption that these children are causing becomes a problem for group learning. So that's why I think what I'm trying to get to is that the kid that is inattentive, off task, in his own world, or misbehaving, or hard to handle is far more likely to be subjected to greater scrutiny and frequent punishment than one who is cooperative and compliant, even if he is disengaged. And let's not forget that there's ample evidence in the literature that makes a case for students with disabilities are punished far too often as compared to their counterparts, those without any disabilities. So that's why it's become very critical that we conceive a new framework that centers around building skills instead of punishing for failing to demonstrate skills. So that's what I'm trying to talk about, is how Julie and I were talking about that bad behaviors and punishment is one way of thinking. And there's another one is helping build skills that manifest through behaviors, which can be disruptive or non-disruptive. So executive function skills are bedrock for personal success. And the sheer presence of these skills is evident in behaviors that were conventionally thought to be matter of will. Hence, I believe that at the heart of this new framework should be the concept of teaching kids way to learn to learn. Here are some key ideas that I feel the parents and educators can inculcate, okay? So one is focus on exposing the kids to rules of education, educational engagement, and then teach behaviors that demonstrate engagement rather than point out when the kid fails to demonstrate those behaviors. Secondly, train kids to know what is most appropriate and acceptable behavior for the classroom context and treat it as a skill. So if a child is in trouble or gets in trouble or is causing trouble, recognize the skill to not cause trouble is not evident. So that's another way to think about. And lastly, what I want to say is when we are dealing with children and when we are going to rethink the way we assess, measure, and relate to behaviors, we have to come from a compassionate place that a child is in process of learning. It's a road that's not done, not been completely built. And so instead of stomping on that road, you need to put the effort to build it. So that's my first takeaway, Todd.
Well, it's important stuff. So we should probably talk about language development too, right? So share with us the relationship between language development and executive function.
Yeah, and so this is getting into the thick of it again. I think Julie and I were talking about, we are fundamentally speech and language pathologists, and we were trained to understand language, development, relationship to cognitive development, its relationship to reading and writing skills. So I'm going to give a little bit of a background there. So we often think language means vocabulary, grammar, complex, or even impeccable oration. But As a speech and language pathologist, I can say language is much more than that. It supports the ability to understand complex issues, figure out the main idea, and form informed opinions. Language allows you to communicate effectively in social interactions by getting your ideas out, defending your point of view, or expressing your thoughts and feelings succinctly and clearly. It's the bedrock of advocacy, or even the way we ask for help is supported by the language that we have. And so we as a society need to appreciate the role of executive function as it is a strong predictor for lifelong success. And one of the means to promote development of executive function is to promote the developmental of fundamental language skills. Children from well-to-do families have an upper hand compared to those who come from impoverished backgrounds, such as they interact with their children more often. The language that is modeled through this interaction happens to have rich content, and the concepts of persuasion and arguments and presenting a point of view and defending it is modeled by parents and provoked through exchanges. On the other hand, children from poverty or children who come from low socioeconomic background, a lot of exchanges are either absent or are minimal, and they are mostly directive in nature, as we were talking in the discussion. So the role of language in developing non-language abilities, such as self-regulation and other language-based skills, such as reading and writing, is very, very important. So people need to understand that language influences thinking and thinking influences language. But another very important concept in executive function is self-talk. That means me talking to myself to think and problem solve for myself. And so this is also known as inner speech. And inner speech is the guidance we give ourselves when we are taking decisions and managing our impulsivity or needing to rethink our belief system. We do something called that inner speech. And so that requires proficiency in language. So, you know, one of my fellow speech language pathologists and a professor from CUNY College, Bela Tropper, summarized this in one of her ASHA talks, that children with a specific language impairment show high frequency of perseveration. You know, they tend to repeat themselves. They show weak resistance to interfering thoughts and ideas. They tend to have problem with expelling unnecessary material from working memory. That means they have trouble managing information while they're taking decisions or acting their thoughts into action. So the effect of this weak executive function on language performance shows up in many ways, such as they're not able to apply the linguistic rules to new situations. You know, they're not able to successfully use the context clues to support their comprehension in language. And that happens, by the way, in reading a lot. It also causes problems with interpretive or non-figurative language. You know, they tend to be very, very literal. So one of the skills, which is executive function skill, is how do you inhibit a one way of meaning only, you know, and activate many meanings. That is also an executive process. Switching topic in conversation, that's another executive function process that is dependent on language, and language influences executive function there, and vice versa. And resolving any conflict, that means understanding meaning of information in the context, that also can pose a challenge for those kids with a specific language impairment. So what I'm trying to say, that there's a huge relationship and strong relationship between language and executive function, and it impacts the skills that go into self-regulation or the way we direct our lives, such as taking decisions, problem solving, impulse control. There's another group of researchers, Singer and Bashir. They once said that metacognitive strategies, which is awareness of awareness, you know, by and large consist of routines that are mediated with language. So language is very important and critical. And children who are growing up in low socioeconomic background have disadvantages created in language, which then feeds into their disadvantage of executive function.
Gosh, a lot to think about here, a lot to process in doing that. I mean, what can parents do about this?
So let's think about this. Most important thing I think parents can do is to develop an understanding of the role they play in promoting language skills and executive function in their children's lives. And we have discussed this earlier in the earlier episode, that if the parent themselves are victims of generational poverty, they are enduring a lot of stressors and chaos themselves. And that can become a full-time preoccupation. Where am I going to get next week's rent? What am I going to do for dinner tonight? You know, oh my God, am I going to get evicted? Oh, I don't have any money to buy gas. You know, if you are preoccupied, there's no way you can be a mentor to your child by having luxury of time to teach or engage with your child. So I think, though, there can be certain things that you can just explain the way to communicate, the way to demonstrate a certain, you know, or establish boundaries even. So Julie made a very important point. Parents can't teach what they don't have. So it's unfair to ask parents to become something that they themselves may have never received. So part of the journey is to kind of create some level of access for these families and help them understand that this issue is a whole family issue. So we need to educate them. We need to offer support and resources. And then we need to teach them how to use these resources effectively to get the outcomes they want. You know, this reminds me of a quick story of fashion designer Andre Leon Talley, who and there's a documentary that's just came out, and he talks about growing up in, you know, rural parts, not rural parts, I guess. He grew up in Durham, North Carolina, and his grandmother was a maid, and she was a very loving, kind, and frugal woman, and had a great sense of self-respect, and she raised Andre lovingly. But he describes that he got exposed to public library, and it opened another world. And most kids his age were playing in the backyard, but Andre was in the library looking at Vogue magazines, you know. So at age 9, he was not only exposed to the beauty and glamour of the way, you know, to relate to the world through the way you present yourself, but he also read a lot of stories. So the reason I feel that this story, you know, struck a chord in this context, that they didn't have a lot. So she provided him safety, but she was not able to provide any enriching environment. But he got exposed to enriching environment through books and reading and Vogue magazine. He tells a story about how he and his grandmother had never talked about anything. She had nothing to say to him. So majority of the time when he would be home, he would be by himself in his room. So I think what's beautiful about this example is if there's safety and if there's allowance made, then the child can be exposed to certain resources and grow from it, you know?
Yeah, no, I get it, Sujata. You know, but so we just talked about what parents can do. Why don't you wrap up the conversation here by sharing what schools and what society can do about this?
Yes. And, you know, in my earlier episode, I kind of went on and on about the saga of growing up in poverty and rethinking America's poverty. And I feel after you listen to the scope and the incredibly vast this problem is, you can feel very discouraged. But the solution can be very simple. As Julie was talking about, you know, one thing that struck a chord with me is this: we need to start a campaign, bring back play. You know, children have been playing since the beginning of time. And as we have kind of formalized the way we educate them, somehow we have gotten lost in translation, that play time is actually wasting time and recess has been taken away. As she was talking about, recess is not just for burning energy, but it is actually to teach some foundational executive function skills, including, you know, social relatability, problem solving, critical thinking, following complex directions, creative problem solving, and most importantly, adaptive adjustability. How do you adapt to circumstances? One of the reasons play is so critical is because there are rules, but they are made up. And the rules keep changing. And you have to kind of either come up with rules or have to adhere to rules that somebody else is asking you to follow. And if you don't like them, you kind of need to not get bent out of shape. If you're trying to impose your rules and nobody follows them, you can't get angry. So it's teaching so many things about emotional management and you know, goal management, and generally equipping children to handle pressures of the unknown. And so I really feel that this can be a phenomenal resource for all of us, that simply go back to the basics, introduce recess, allow children to do free play, and let some innovation come into their lives, no matter what social strata they come from, where they are given an opportunity to be children and experience new skills through exposure to things that bring joy, not just the formal pressures of learning.
Great stuff. Yeah, no, I'm all for that. I can't believe that we have to have a discussion around bringing recess back. I mean, that's just that just should be such a part of the fabric of what we do for our children. So great stuff. Boy, these two conversations with Julie have been just fascinating stuff. So really grateful to you, Sujata, for bringing her on the show. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for today. On behalf of our host, Sujata Kamath, and all of us at Cerebral Matters, thank you for listening today. We look forward to seeing you again right here next week on Full Prefrontal.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive functions. To contact our host, Sujata Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive functions, visit her website at CerebralMatters.com. That's CerebralMatters.com. Tune in next week for the next informative episode of Full Prefrontal.